Venturing gingerly into the musical forest, I soon came to a place where the road split in two. One path was well-traveled, wide and clearly marked. The other was narrow, difficult to see, and somewhat foreboding. One path had been followed by the multitudes and promised easy companionship and social acceptance. The other was overgrown, meandered aimlessly all over the countryside, and offered no guarantee that you'd ever run across a fellow traveler. I stood in the record store, weighing my options. In one hand, the first Boston album. In the other, the first Peter Gabriel album. I bought them both, and that has made all the difference. I bought the first Peter Gabriel album not because of who he was or where he had come from, but because he had supplied the titles for the tracks on Chords, the third Synergy album. It may seem an odd reason to buy a record, but the world of popular music was virtually unknown to me, and any road in was as good as another. Larry Fast's astonishing palette of synthetic textures and the epic, sophisticated music that he released under his nom de stylus Synergy was the center of my musical universe. It was the very reason I had become interested in music to begin with, and anything that he touched was a holy relic worth exploring. For all his qualities, however, Fast struggled with track titles, an admittedly arcane and specialized skill for instrumentals. He fought through a second album with titles like Escape and Cybersports, and then got Peter to jazz up Chords with Disruption in World Communication, On Presuming to Be Modern, and Phobos and Deimos Go to Mars, among others. Larry Fast gave up entirely on the next album, calling everything Delta 1, Delta 2, and so on, although, perversely, he puts them out of order on the record. Of course, being so fascinated with every facet of Fast's career led to a lot of unusual purchases that have shamed me in later years. Nektar? Intergalactic touring band? Foreigner? But I had read that Peter Gabriel was good buddies with Larry, in other words, Fast friends. And the fact that he was wise enough to pick the greatest synthesist of all time to support his songs was a good enough recommendation for me. So I ended up buying it along with the Boston album, which I already heard and knew I liked. That was a fateful day, as those happened to be the very first rock albums I ever purchased, and are the foundation on which so much rests. The Boston album was very slick and seductive and easy to like, and everybody had it. The Peter Gabriel album, however, was something else entirely. The songs were unusual both in form and content. He shied away from easy conventions and instrumentation, and even managed to slip in a song in 7/4 that was so natural sounding that it was years before I noticed the unusual time signature. Climbing up on Salisbury Hill, I could see the city light. Wind was blowing, time stood still. Eagle be honest, I didn't really like the album that much, but because I had spent my monthly allowance on it, and because it was one of only a dozen or so albums that I owned, I kept playing it.
I saw the man at JFK. He took your ticket yesterday. In the humdrum, in the humdrum, I write tandem with the random. Things don't run the way I planned them. In the humdrum, in the humdrum. Hey Valentina, you want me to bake? You got me cooking, I'm a hard-boiled egg. In the humdrum, in the humdrum. Empty my mind, I find it hard to cope. Listen to my heart, don't need no stethoscope.
Gradually, its tentacles slipped through my ears and into my brain, and I came to really like it, or parts of it anyway. I was never fully able to embrace the entire album. But the new synapses that it created in my head permanently altered my way of listening to music, and may be as responsible for my current collection and taste in music as anything else. It led me down the primrose path, and I learned to savor the thorns along the way, and treasure the unusual vistas that following the road less heard led me to. If I had to forego some social currency with my peers, so be it. It was a price well worth paying for the joy that the search for interesting and unusual music has brought me over the years. On the other hand, maybe I would have gotten laid sooner if I had slipped into the mainstream along with everybody else I knew. The Peter Gabriel album was interesting, but didn't compel me to buy his second album, called, like the first, Peter Gabriel. But I had heard good things about his third album, Peter Gabriel, and picked that up one day. The idea, I later learned, was that he wanted each of his records to be like issues of a magazine, so they were all titled the same, and the title was always in the same typeface for each of the first three albums. He later dropped the conceit, or rather, his label did, and then he gave it up. So those first three albums are more commonly known by the features of the covers. There's the one where he's black and white and sitting in a rainy blue car, the one where he's scratching off the surface of his own photograph from within, and the one that features a black and white Polaroid of Gabriel manipulated during developing to make it look like his face is melting. Car, scratch, and melt.
Find me.
Melt is a great album, very close to perfect. Only Not One of Us falls short of the mark for me. And the first of his solo albums that really feels like he's found his footing all the way through. Gabriel is one of those rare musicians that is able to bridge the conventional and the experimental without sounding forced in either camp. He has great pop sensibilities and was more than happy to be called a pop musician back in the early 1980s when that was anything but cool. But he's also fiercely independent and uncompromisingly dedicated to pursuing his own path through the musical jungle. One of the reasons Melt marks a departure from the first two releases is that it was the first album to really emphasize rhythm, the key that would unlock Gabriel's future. For the recording sessions, he took away former Genesis mate and drummer Phil Collins' cymbals, which was scandalous for the time, and frankly, still is. Without the shimmery sheen of cymbals, the album automatically takes on a darker, more menacing tone, which perfectly complements the shadowy songs of fear and alienation. That threatening tone is apparent just from reading the titles of his songs. Intruder, No Self-Control, I Don't Remember, Not One of Us. There's a claustrophobic feel to the sounds as they bump and scrape their way through the songs. The album is full of creaking metal and strangled guitars and sounds as if it was recorded underwater in the middle of the night, airless and disoriented. Melt had a minor hit, Games Without Frontier, in which his buddy, weirdo musician Kate Bush, sings the title in French, Jour Sans Frontière, which my friend Alan always heard as She's So Fucking A. But the real breakthrough was the last track, the monumental Biko, about martyred black activist Stephen Biko, who died suspiciously while being detained by the police in South Africa. The track marks a departure from earlier Gabriel, even from earlier on that same album, by being built up directly from an extended rhythm pattern and by being more socially conscious in content. Oh, Almost all of the rest of the album is internal, Peter putting on different disguises, a thief, an assassin, to explore the dark terrain of his own psyche. Biko, by contrast, looks outward, and, though tragic in telling, is hopeful in tone, and points the way towards the birth of what some have come to call Saint Peter, the guardian angel of social activism through a deeper appreciation of the different musical idioms of the world. That promise is delivered in full on his fourth self-titled album, which his label called Security, a name that has stuck and marks the end of his run of musical magazines. His new rhythmic thesis is laid out in full on the opening track, The Rhythm of the Heat. A compelling African drum pattern slowly dissolves in from the shimmering silence. The layers of rhythm are gradually built up and elaborated upon as Gabriel sings about being drawn into the rhythm of an exotic culture. A musical version of Carl Jung's metaphysical reaction to visiting a group of African drummers, The Rhythm of the Heat captures in both form and content the experience of losing your polished Western civilized veneer in the face of some more compelling primal rhythmic calling. It also perfectly illustrates Gabriel's new mandate to pursue and explore the rhythms of the world. Gabriel holds this last word in a soaring arc for a full 15 seconds as the rhythms of his soul explode in a complex polyrhythmic jam, and the album is off and running. This was the first album that I ran across that really used the Fairlight CMI, computer musical instrument, the absolute state of the art of synthesis at the time. Prohibitively expensive, like six figures, the Fairlight was the first real sampler, the first instrument that could use digital recordings of sounds as a source instead of the pure, simple tones most other synthesizers employed. And you could use the Fairlight to perform all kinds of audio alchemy to the sounds. You could take the features of a piano sound and lay them over a violin. You could cross a voice with a chainsaw. You could hear what a tuba sounded like in the flute register. To be fair, the first time I heard the Fairlight was on the Buggles' second album, Adventures in Modern Recording. But they used it mostly to recreate and slightly tweak already existing sounds. Gabriel was the first person I heard to really start to exploit the power of this new instrument by combining sounds in freakish Frankenstein ways to create brand new sonic textures never heard before.
Sat in the corner of the garden grill with the plastic flowers on the windowsill.
He'd scrape a pipe and then use that sound and mix it with a dozen other unusual timbres to create an eerily familiar and wholly exotic palette of noise to work from.
Reaction levels much too high. I can do without the stimuli.
Sometimes Songs for this album were built up by exploring these different textures and by playing with and jamming over rhythms, instead of the more traditionally Western method of building up melody and harmony first and then figuring out what clothes to dress it up in. Security was released in 1982. That spring, I had a history teacher who started his class with a long discussion of the concept of specious present. He said that in order to study history, we tended to break it apart into little units of relatively self-contained time, which is what we were doing in his class by studying the Civil War. The way we learned American history, which was the only kind I was allowed to study, tended to make it seem like a series of discrete, disconnected events. The landing at Plymouth Rock in the early settlement was followed after a period of inactivity by the American Revolution. Another dry spell and then the Civil War. More nothing and then the Great Depression and so on. But, he explained, history wasn't like that. Everything connected with everything else, and you really could never point out where something started and something else ended, or if you could, there would be a great deal of overlap involved. But that was too hard to hold on to, so we broke time apart, tear the day to shreds, as Gabriel says in The Rhythm of the Heat, so we could hold the parcels in our head more easily. But, he warned, it was a false construct, and nothing ever broke apart cleanly. 3 months later, I proved him wrong. That was the last history class I took in high school, and upon completing it and my other courses of that semester, I took my rightful place among my graduating class, accepted the shower of honors and praise that fell upon me, and strode cheerfully into the void. The day after graduation, everything stopped. Being that Interlaken is a boarding school that attracts students from all over the world, the moment an academic year ends, the community shatters beyond repair. All of my closest and most precious friends were suddenly completely out of reach, scattered across the country. And the worst blow was the fact that, because I lived in Interlaken, I was still there after everybody left. I was still rattling around those sacred, haunted places where so much had happened and so many bonds had been forged. The emptiness of the campus mocked me, and I slipped into a disorienting depression. On top of that, my mother and stepfather had grown used to me living in the dorm, and had come to enjoy life without me in the house, and now I no longer belonged there, either. I was constantly underfoot and in the way. They had recently formed a strong bond with some neighbors, and would spend almost all day every day laughing and playing with them while I was conspicuously ignored. They had a favorite card game, which could only be played with four people, and they would spend hours every night laughing and chatting over this game while I sat in my room, hearing the echoes of their joy and, through that, the echoes of my own dearly departed friends, and feeling completely, hopelessly alone. The tension became unbearable, and I ended up stealing the family car one day, and driving it as far as I could until there was no sign left of Interlaken or my friends or anything that meant anything to me. The summer dragged slowly by. I had a job painting cabins, and painting them all Chateau Brown, which I absolutely abhorred. I was going to college in the fall, and I was looking forward to starting a new experience in a new environment. Little did I know. But that was all in the future, and everything else I knew and loved was all in the past. I was suspended in a strange twilight netherworld where nothing happened and nobody knew me. Time had stopped, and I was stuck like a bug in amber.
Smash the radio. No outside voices here. Smash the watch. Count
data shreds. Fortunately, smash I had security. And Roxy Music's Avalon, and Thomas Dolby, and Trees, and Nina Hagen to get me through that summer. I used to turn my stereo up to the breaking point and scream along with Peter.
The rhythm has my soul.
The summer from hell did, of course, finally end, and history creaked back into action as I packed my things up in a car and drove with my mother down to Chicago to begin attending classes at the University of Chicago, or technically the College of the University of Chicago. I knew before I graduated from Interlochen that I didn't want to pursue my dance career any farther than I had. I'd enjoyed it, but I didn't burn to dance. I didn't need to do it in order to survive. And I knew from growing up around dancers my whole life that that was the only way to make it. The dancer's life is so hard and so unrewarding, not to mention so short, that the only way to make a go of it was if it was truly the only thing you ever wanted to do. And that was not the case for me. But it did leave a giant hole in my life as I was dancing 5 or 6 hours a day when I graduated. The sudden loss of such a strong focus played no small part in my disorientation that summer, to be sure, but I knew I had closed that particular chapter of my life and was ready for something else. But what? Before devoting myself to dance, I had always been good at academics and enjoyed studying and learning, so I thought I would go to an academic college and try to rekindle that fire. Having spent 10 years in the woods, I wanted to try living in a city for a change, but I didn't want to be so far away that I couldn't get home for the occasional weekend. Chicago was a natural choice, and when the U of C offered me a generous financial aid package, my fate was sealed. As we unpacked the car and brought boxes up to my new room, I was grateful that the summer was finally over and I could dig into a new experience. I was apprehensive, to be sure, but at least I was doing something. I had a purpose and a focus and a reason to be there. After unloading my boxes, I went for a last dinner with my mom, bid her a tearful goodbye, and walked back up to my room to begin my new life and meet my new roommate. And I promptly jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire. Like most people, I am an onion. I have a public face and a private persona, and there are a lot of layers in between the two. When you meet me, you meet the outside of the onion. The better I get to know you and the more I come to trust you, the more layers I'll peel off. Most people only make it past the first layer or two. Very rare is the person who I'll allow to see the naked little scallion within. It's purely a matter of emotional survival and something I think everybody does to some extent or another. You don't want some insensitive oaf stomping around on your psyche, so you tend to only show people as much of yourself as you can stand to have them destroy. The better the friend, the more of you they can destroy. But hopefully, by that time, you're good enough friends that they won't want to destroy you, so they've earned your trust. And also, by that time, you've worked your way under their skin, too. So if they're suddenly going to start slashing and burning, you know right where to strike back. When I showed up at the U of C, I really needed a friend, and the first person I saw was my roommate, David. So I threw caution to the wind, pretended we were already friends, and peeled the first few layers off. David, as it turned out, was not worth getting past the crinkly brown paper-like surface. But it was too late. I had already flashed him my inner onion. He was an extremely uptight, terribly repressed academic overachiever, which was something I was soon to learn was pretty much a prerequisite for attending U of C. He came from that area just north of Chicago that, at the time, was the teenage suicide capital of the country. That community is the setting for Judith Guest's Ordinary People, which had relatively recently been turned into a highly acclaimed film by Robert Redford, and which seemed to perfectly capture the awkward, pressurized family situation that spawned David. He was an honor student and an academic whiz, and had spent his entire high school career buttering up his grades and resume so he could get into a good school, which would lead him to a good grad school, which would lead him to a highly respected and financially rewarding career as a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. You know, one of those guys. In contrast, I was a dance fag from some artsy-fartsy boarding school and must have gotten accepted into this prestigious college by blowing the dean or something, or so he seemed to think. And not entirely condescendingly, either. Although hyper-repressed, he was sexually curious and was excited to explore, and just as quick to deny, his homosexual urges. And here I was, a dancer and everything. He was so fixated on appearances and stereotypes that it didn't matter how many times I told him I was more interested in girls than guys. The very fact that I was a dancer made me gay to him, and he propositioned me many times that semester, especially when he was drunk. The first big rift in our relationship happened during the first week. Being a very traditional school, U of C had a core of required classes. You had to take physics and you had to take calculus, among others, but they gave everybody a test in the first week to see which level of those classes you were best suited for. It warned you at the beginning of the multiple choice test not to guess if you didn't know the answer, but by that time I had taken far too many standardized tests in my life to pay any attention to that advice. David was sure he would do better than me on those tests because of all of his advanced placement classes and extracurricular academics, and here I was, some flaky dance fag, after all. But I passed completely out of physics, which is laughable since I'd never taken it, and got placed into accelerated calculus, while he was placed into what was affectionately known as math for trees. As it turned out, getting placed in accelerated calculus was a big mistake, as it was way too hard for me. I tried to get reassigned to a lower level, but my counselor thought I was just trying to shirk, pointed to my test score, and sent me back to class, which ultimately I passed with a D- because my teacher was too sympathetic to fail me. Things rapidly deteriorated between David and me. He had apparently never met anybody like me, a guy who talked about his feelings and didn't really give a shit about what other people thought, and fell in love with me. I, on the other hand, had never really met somebody like him. Somebody so repressed and scared and unwilling to confront his own interior life, and as soon as I discovered how fucked up he was, I tried to push him back out of my life, which is hard to do when you live with a guy. He'd not only read my mail, he would write in it. He used to like to sit on my bed while I was trying to go to sleep. Very relaxing. We got into terrible fights. He's the only person that I've ever met that I can truly say that I've hated. Not disliked, not disagreed with, but actively, passionately hated. Eventually, he came around and started hating me, too. But the problem wasn't so much that he was so completely fucked up and held all the wrong values. The problem was that, in the rarefied academia of the University of Chicago, I was the fucked up one. I believed in the power of art and of the absolute necessity of creative exploration and in the redemption of intimate, and not just in a sexual way, relationships. I was the odd man out. I had gone through the looking glass, and everything that was good and right with my world had been turned inside out in this hostile, cold, dark landscape where numbers and formulas reigned supreme, and the human element was regarded with skepticism, if at all. It was all very ugly and depressing and made me feel profoundly alone.
6x6 from wall to wall. Shutters on the windows, no light at all. Damp on the floor, you got damp in the bed. They're trying to get you crazy, get you out of your head. And they feed you scraps, and they feed you lies. Time your body.
When Peter Gabriel was touring to support Melt, he stayed in a hotel in the American Southwest, New Mexico or Arizona, something like that. While there, he started talking to a bellboy who worked at the hotel. The bellboy, as it turned out, was a Native American, and they got into a discussion about what it was like to try and hold on to your cultural beliefs in a society that openly mocked them. From that discussion came the second track on Security, San Jacinto. The story of a young Native American man on a vision quest, it juxtaposes the crass commercialization of Western society with the spiritual truths of his culture. The song is very powerful and builds its strength through a slow introduction, filled with delicate rhythms and fragments of images both sacred, red paint, eagle feathers, and profane, Geronimo's Disco, Sittin' Bull Steakhouse. Halfway through this fragile pastiche, as the snakebite poison grabs hold of the initiate, the song explodes with huge guitar chords and drums, and Gabriel shouts, this song was what I held on to through those dark and frightening months in Chicago. A stranger in my own strange land, I knew that what I valued was real and that the world around me was poisoned. I was alone in this belief, but I was sure of it, and this song helped me hold on to that frail thread. Gabriel's protagonist doubts his ability, but he holds on too. That was me in a nutshell, in a pebble, in a curled up fetal position, rocking on my bed. But right away again, the soaring chords and the strong assertion. If he could do it, so could I. I wouldn't let them kill me. I, too, would live to see the yellow eagle fly down from the sun. I took great comfort from that song, and from others on the album. There was a deep spirituality buried throughout the disc, and it nourished my soul while I wandered lost through the valley of the shadow of death. I Have the Touch celebrates the joy and necessity of human contact with a catchy, stuttering drum pattern, which still never fails to lighten my spirits whenever I hear it.
The time I like is the rush hour, 'cause I like the rush, the pushing of the people. I like it all so much. Such a mass of motion, do not know where it goes.
Lay Your Hands on Me is a complex rhythmic fugue full of beautifully modulated textures that builds from a ghostly whisper to a thundering, soul-shattering climax. Wallflower is a delicate love letter of encouragement to a victim of imprisonment and torture, and, in my darkest hours, felt like it was written directly to me. A few weeks into the school year, I saw a notice proclaiming that there were going to be auditions for a televised talent contest later that month. I decided it was just the thing I needed to lift my spirits and give me focus and reaffirm the creative part of my personality, what I felt to be the most important part of me, which had been stifled and was suffocating in this cold, gray, windy city. I ripped the flyer from the wall and took it back to my room. It was for a series to be run on the recently launched Disney Channel that featured college students from primarily academic schools showcasing their other talents. I briefly considered entering some piano pieces I had written, but knew that my real talent at that point was still dance. Plus, I longed for the kind of confidence and sense of self I had had as a dancer, so I decided to choreograph and perform a solo. The only problem was that you had to perform your talent for 10 minutes, and the audition was in 3 weeks. That's not much time for a lot of choreography. I wanted to use something from Security, since I loved it so, but was concerned about filling up the audition time, so I chose the longest track, The Family and the Fishing Net, which runs just over 7 minutes. I combined it with the last track on Brian Eno and David Byrne's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and I was there. Unfortunately, The Family and the Fishing Net was my least favorite track on the album. It was too long and too obtuse, and it was ugly and awkward, but it fit my mood perfectly, and I happened to have a green fishing net in my room, so I choreographed an elaborate piece in which I ended up completely cocooned in the net, unable to move. It was dark and angry, and I loved working on it, giving shape to my seething emotions. While working on it one day, I took a break and sat down at the piano to play through a piece I had recently written. leagues better than anything else I'd ever composed, the piece was given to me by the Muses and summed up a lot of my wistful and nostalgic feelings. As I finished, this woman burst into the room. She told me how she had been outside and had heard the Peter Gabriel piece and thought it was the devil's music, dark and foreboding and wholly evil, and was just walking away in disgust when I sat down and played my piece. That piece, she said, was so full of hope and light that it was hard for her to believe that the same person could respond to these two extremes, and she had just come in to see who this person was. She babbled on like this for a while and then ran away, leaving me to wonder again just what kind of place I had gotten myself into. I auditioned the piece and was accepted, but when it came to the taping of the show, the producers decided it was going to be too expensive to try to get permission to use those songs. So we quickly worked up a scene in which I improvised a dance piece to some piano noodling by one of the producers, and they shot it as though this was just something they had stumbled across while touring the campus. The rest of the show was taped live in front of an audience, and they just pretended to show my piece, which was to be cut in later, and then brought me out to get a warm hand from the audience. Part of the reason I had wanted to do this program was to show these corpses I went to school with what the real me was all about and why I was so unhappy there. But nobody actually got to see me dance, and now they were supposed to give me a round of appreciative applause for doing nothing and being singled out and standing in front of them. It was stupid and humiliating, and wholly appropriate for my year in Chicago. They had said that the rights to use a Peter Gabriel track would be too expensive for a show like that, and I know they were right, but I can't help but wonder if they also thought the piece I had choreographed was a bit strong. After all, everybody else was performing Flight of the Bumblebee or balancing bicycles on their face. That was an actual talent. And here I was ripping my heart out and wrapping it in a bloody net to the cruel and disturbing sounds of Gabriel's tortured song for the Disney Channel. Around this time, Peter Gabriel's commitment to underrepresented cultures led him to help start the WOMAD Festival, WOMAD standing for World of Music, Art, and Dance. WOMAD was designed to be a yearly festival that brought artists, musicians, and craftsmen from around the world together to share in each other's creativity. Despite a strong opening and a wonderful collaborative album celebrating the festival, called Music and Rhythm, the festival's numbers dropped off during the 80s. After Security, Peter Gabriel began the first of a series of long hiatuses. Between albums. It was a full 4 years before his next studio album, So, was released. The soundtrack to Birdie was released in the interim, but that consists mostly of slightly rearranged pieces from his back catalog, so I don't really count that as an album. At the time, a friend commented that they thought So actually stood for Sell Out, and it was easily his most accessible and publicly successful album, but was far from a sellout. His interest and enthusiasm for rhythm and ethnic instrumentation continued on So, but was much more internalized and subtle than it had been on Security. Although So is mostly remembered for his biggest hits and most popular videos, Sledgehammer and Big Time, it's also home to the thundering drums of Red Rain and the heartbreaking beauty of Mercy Street and the soaring, glorious In Your Eyes. Another 3 years of silence had Peter working hard on setting up Real World, a label and studio complex dedicated to the cross-pollinization of the world's musical cultures amidst a warm and inviting atmosphere of mutual admiration and respect. Real World represents the absolute pinnacle of Peter's commitment to building a global community. It is nothing less than a utopian model for how societies must put their differences aside and come together in respect and blend their cultures and ideologies to form a new, vital world culture. Some people fear that their individual identities, that peculiar mix of culture and history that makes each person and each society what it is, will get lost in such a blending of cultures, and that the rich variety of traditions that makes the world the vibrant, colorful place it is will turn into a bland, beige McSoup, with no flavor, no color, no past, and therefore no future. But real world proves that it's possible to unite different idioms and structures together in a way that the synergistic end result still retains the individual flavors that went into its creation. Instead of a melting pot, the metaphor of choice is that of a mosaic, each bright tile retaining all of its individual color and fire, but contributing to a beautiful picture that's only possible through the collective and carefully controlled contributions of many different tiles. Peter Gabriel launched the ambitious real-world experiment by releasing Passion, his reworked soundtrack for Martin Scorsese's controversial film, The Last Temptation of Christ. Passion is Gabriel's most beautiful and profound album. On it, he assembled some of the best musicians in the world and carefully crafted a searing, spiritual soundscape that goes far beyond merely supporting Scorsese's images. It is a sonic temple, an oral testament to the deeply satisfying and redemptive powers of faith of all kinds. The spirituality that has fluttered around the edges of Gabriel's solo work takes center stage here, but it is spirituality without dogma. It is inclusive. It is us. Significantly, Gabriel, a man first known to the world as the vocalist for Genesis, doesn't sing a single word on the album. There are lots of vocals on the album, by him and others, but they are all wordless vocals, soaring, grunting, wailing voices of pleasure and pain. The effect is that the music is universal in appeal. By not singling out one language or one story or one musical idiom, it invites everybody along. The album weaves many different strands together, sounding alternately European, African, Middle Eastern, and Asian. It is the soundtrack for a world religion, musical manna for the masses, both high and low. And it is also that rarest of achievements. It is a perfect album. Thank you. 3 years later saw the release of the highly anticipated Us, a return to the path he was following with So. After the shining pinnacle of Passion, Us was a bit of a letdown. It's still a wonderful album, but this time it's much more personal than universal.
Something in me, dark and sticky. All the time it's getting strong.
It deals with issues in Peter's own life, but like any good artist, he's able to tell the personal in such a way that it's recognizable to everyone. There are some beautifully heartbreaking moments on the album, especially the somber, melancholy Washing of the Water. Peter Gabriel has a wide range of musical interests and abilities, but one of his strongest skills, and one that is rarely acknowledged, is his facility with heartbreaking ballads.
If I should fall, would you swallow me deep inside?
A good ballad is hard to write, too easily tipping into the maudlin. But Gabriel handles the emotions carefully, and some of his most stirring work is some of his quietest.
Feel like I'm sinking down.
The Washing of the Water is one of those tracks. Quietly confessional, achingly lonely, you can hear the resignation sinking into Peter's fragile voice.
We're here in this water, my feet won't touch the ground.
Another such track, one of his most haunting, is buried on his next, sort of, album, Ovo. Ovo is an odd document. Commissioned for the turn of the millennium as part of London's Millennium Dome celebration, Ovo is a concept album of sorts, the soundtrack of a multimedia theater experience relating a somewhat confusing creation myth involving sky people and water people as they deal with issues of faith and technology and prejudice and who all knows what. Although it bears his name, Ovo is a soundtrack more than a Peter Gabriel standalone album, which is why it may not have received distribution outside of England. Ovo was supposed to be quite a spectacle, a visual feast, but without those visuals, the album falls a little flat. Although covering a wide range of material, from rap to ambient to Irish jigs, the album never quite coalesces. The tracks and moods bump awkwardly into each other. The quality of the material is quite uneven, too, despite the collected efforts of, among others, Elizabeth Fraser from Cocteau Twins, Nana Cherry, the Electro Strings, the Afro-Celt sound system, and Paul Buchanan from the Blue Nile. It's a very uneven affair, for while it contains some of the worst material ever recorded under Peter's flag, the opening track is horrifically bad, it also contains a few beautiful gems. One of the most beautiful is the heartbreaking Father, Son. Most men, if they want children, picture a future of playing catch in the backyard or going fishing or laying in the hammock and talking with their adoring progeny. Almost no man pictures themselves with an infant. There's a reason for this. It's because it's awful. Early childhood has to be one of the most irritating and frustrating stages of a person's life, for everyone involved, including the infant, although I say this having yet to experience adolescence from the other side. I knew it would be difficult, but I really had no idea how difficult it would be. When Ovo came out, my son Owen was 2, and I was just about at the end of my rope. For months, when I came home from work, he would burst into tears. It was just unfortunate timing, I knew, because he was tired and cranky right before bedtime, but it was getting so that it was the only time I'd see him. Plus, he hated going to sleep, and you usually had to lie with him for at least an hour every night, patiently coaxing him to slumber while he did everything possible to stay awake. If you got irritated, and it was almost impossible not to, then he'd get upset and you'd have to start it all over again. It was awful. And I really didn't know how either of us were going to survive.
With my dad by my side.
Because of my own difficult relationship with my father, I had a great deal of ambivalence about becoming a father in the first place, and now it seemed all my worst fears were coming true, and I was sinking into a well of despair with my own little eraser head there to taunt and torture me.
Mantras and hymns, unfolding limbs, looking for release through the pain.
OVO came out, and because it was the first release from Gabriel in 8 years, I made a special trip to the Virgin Megastore to pick it up. My excitement at getting my hands on the new Gabriel album were almost immediately tempered by hearing the first track, but like that first album of his all those years ago, I persevered.
With his dad by his side.
When I heard the sixth cut, my blood froze.
God is dead by his side.
The music, gently fragile, bolstered by stately funereal horns, is wistful, frightened, and vulnerable.
We couldn't talk much at all.
Peter's meditation on aging and fatherhood caught me by surprise and hit me right behind the eyes.
Now these tears, guess I'm still your child.
The image of a boy gathering strength from his father and then watching that strength ebb out was more than I could take. I thought about how I felt about my father growing up, how impossibly strong and sure and smart and loving he was, how he could do no wrong, and how, over the years, he could then do no right. And now he was gone, and I was the father, and here was my beautiful, frightened, trusting boy looking up to me to hold back the tide. Someday, Owen will see me for what I am, a mere mortal, only a man, tired and scared and frayed around the edges. Someday I will hold his hand to feel the warmth of life, and he will look at me across the years and feel the cold seeping into my fingers and wonder what became of me.
With my dad by my side. With my dad by my side. Got my dad by my side with me.
I could hold the tide back no more, and the tears poured out of me, washing me clean. That was a turning point in my relationship with Owen. He began talking, and I let go of a lot of my fears, and we tangled together. I still know the winter's coming, but I'm happy to enjoy the warmth of the sun on my face right now. My son. After one of the longest droughts in current popular music, Peter Gabriel released Up in 2002.
I'm
Up is a wondrous, bleak, beautiful, powerful, terrifying sprawl. Returning after 20 years to the claustrophobic airlessness of Melt, Up is a very personal, very dark album. It's angry and sad and bristles with energy. It is not for the faint-hearted, and those rainy day fans who are hoping for another Sledgehammer will be disappointed. But if you're willing to put in the time, there's much to be reaped from this album.
Afraid of what I do not know. I feel undermined. I'm afraid I can be gentleman. And I'm scared to be divine. Don't mess with me. My fuse is short. Beneath this skin, these fragments cork.
When I allow it to be.
The textures and dynamics are foreboding, and most of the songs hover around the 7-minute mark. But there's a subtle beauty and underlying strength to the album that are truly astonishing. Facing mortality head-on, Gabriel digs deep into the black earth and uncovers startling bones of emotion. It is not a perfect album by any means, but it is enormously satisfying and worthy of a decade's wait. Although we've never met, and aren't likely to, I consider Peter Gabriel to be one of my better friends. More than almost anybody else, he has helped me in times of crisis, and has encouraged me to look within for the strength to live life. His emotional honesty, his musical integrity, and his open-armed approach to the cultures of the world are greatly inspiring. Because of his beautiful music and the noble experiments of WOMAD and Real World, some call him Saint Peter. But I prefer to think of him as just Gabriel, the angel, blowing his horn to cleanse the world of hate and fear and calling forth the musical rapture.